The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It seems that the only thing that could get him his desire is to destroy Ukraine. And what this is likely going to look like is a major, major military offensive. I've described it as the largest offensive in Europe since World War II. And it's going to look like shock and awe, like desert elements of Desert Storm, just for a frame of reference. Enormous use of air power, cruise missiles, long-range fires, long-range artillery. One of the fundamental objectives is a military objective. It's actually to destroy the Ukrainian armed forces.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 23rd, 2022. Vladimir Putin has recognized two separatist regions in Ukraine. He has sent Russian troops as so-called peacekeepers to defend them. And all of this seems to be presaging a wider war in Ukraine. The United States and lots of other countries have announced sanctions. It's all heating up very fast. So we got together in the Virtual Jungle Studio, Alex Vindman, Pritzker Military Fellow at the Lawfare Institute, and Scott R. Anderson, Lawfare Senior Editor, to talk it all through. What is Vladimir Putin doing? What can we expect militarily? Why did he go through this Byzantine process of recognizing these two non-states? Are we expecting a wider conflict or a narrow one? What do the prospects look like for either? And will the international community hang together? It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 23rd. Russia attacks Ukraine.
So, Alex, get us started, since you're the defense minister of Ukraine. Is there, at this point, any significant hope to avoid war or a larger conflict and have this remain, you know, Russian incursions into places that they've already have had troops, or is this now destined to be a larger conflagration?
No, no, and yes. But let me expound on that. First of all, we know that we're not at the highest point of this military offensive because the Russians would have attacked if I was the Minister of Defense by now. But to answer your question about diplomacy, I think, frankly, I would say that Vladimir Putin's pretty much closed off all of the reasonable off-ramps to diplomacy. So the most likely scenario for a diplomatic off-ramp up until yesterday morning was that somehow, in spite of holding amazingly firm, like man of steel, firm to Ukraine's sovereignty and independence, unbending to Russian pressure, there was still the chance that somehow Zelensky was going to compromise and try to fulfill the Minsk agreements according to Russia's wishes, because that's been a longstanding issue about, you know, what Minsk accords required, what obligations were on the Russian and Ukrainian side. But the Russians, of course, wanted them to do it in their manner, which would give Russia a veto over the geopolitical orientation of Ukraine. So that is shut down now. Minsk doesn't exist anymore. Putin said as much, you know, just within the last several minutes. He said he also signed several decrees recognizing the, according to him, independent states of Luhansk and Donetsk Democratic Republics. Part of the issue that he clarified today, which was, you know, initially seemed like it was going to be provide a little bit of a, I don't know, a temperature regulation, was that it was going to be maybe within the confines of the existing boundaries of those territories. And that means that the current boundaries can expand. You know, they're one third of the total territory of Luhansk and Donetsk Oblast. So that's gone. Joe Biden and the West were unflinching in pushing back on Russia's demands for a veto over European security orientation. That was not going to happen. You know, that was something that was basically discounted for months now, and at the cost of potentially a war in Ukraine to stand on principles. So that's not going to happen. And then Putin, who always has the most flexibility because he's an autocrat, could pivot in a different direction. But he's also kind of locked himself in. He now has these shows, these demonstrations for his population with regards to the Security Council, with regards to his can't be described anything other than a rant on TV to the Russian population. And then, you know, by these actions, even by the rubber stamps from the Duma for Russia conducting military operations outside of his borders. So I'd say the diplomatic component to this, at least for the foreseeable future, is not relevant. I think it could reemerge again, you know, once Russia believes it achieved some of its aims, or once pressure has been ratcheted up on Russia to such a degree that it starts to kind of reverse course on some of its objectives. With regards to the offensive, I kind of gave a little bit of the context, but it's worth expanding on why we're still almost certain to have a major military offensive. And the reason is that Putin just gave up his leverage. If his idea was that he could somehow coerce Ukraine into granting Putin a veto, a say in Ukraine's orientation through Minsk, he's cast that aside. So he's eliminated his leverage, and he still has 200,000 troops on his border, and he staked his credibility on the line. And it would be a bad idea for him to reverse course at this point. From a personal credibility standpoint, he'd be vulnerable, even though he's by far the most powerful actor in Russia, to reverse course like this. And he couldn't be, you know, from here on out, people would doubt his veracity with regards to his saber rattling.
Well, that sounds pretty bleak. So when you say a major offensive, do you mean conquer and wipe out Ukraine, or do you mean something that merely is beyond the borders, even the expanded notional borders of the Donbas oblasts? Are you expecting Ukraine to be sort of removed as a sovereign entity from the face of the earth in the next few weeks?
It's probably closer to that, unfortunately, than more limited gains, because Putin has certainly detected a low regard for his threats from the Ukrainians. The 8-year war and the acquisition of some 7% of Ukraine's territory was not sufficient to realizing a Ukrainian, you know, a pro-Russian Ukrainian state, or a failed state for that matter. It's going, so he's a limited objective, as in like expanding just these two territories, is just simply not going to get him what he wants, which is control over Ukraine. Part of his, you know, his rant yesterday was this idea that Ukraine is not even a legitimate state. It's a cut from whole cloth out of, you know, some Russian or Soviet idea of creating a state, which is, these are all completely false narratives, but that's what he said repeatedly. He said this for years, not just yesterday. He had a long, like 5,000, 6,000 word essay in the summer. And he's been saying this for years, that Ukraine's not a real state. So it seems that the only thing that could get him his desire is to destroy Ukraine. And what this is likely going to look like is a major, major military offensive. I've described it as the largest offensive in Europe since World War II. And it's going to look like shock and awe, like desert elements of Desert Storm, just for frame of reference. Enormous use of air power, cruise missiles, long-range fires, long-range artillery. One of the fundamental objectives is a military objective. It's actually to destroy the Ukrainian armed forces so that Ukraine doesn't have the means to resist. But that's not going to be the end of it. He's also going to look to destroy the will of the population to resist. And there, I think he's going to go after what I've called morale targets. Things that are meaningful to the Ukrainian population have been significant to Ukrainian conceptions of national identity. So the Maidan Square, where the Orange Revolution and the 2014 Revolution of Dignity, other cultural sites. I think there's a good chance he's going to actually target civilian populations in this effort. I can explain why this is the case and why he doesn't see significant cost there. That could be a follow-up, but I think those are part of the formula. And then he's going to go after the political targets. And there are all sorts of different tools he has there. It could be like long-range fires to kill the political leadership of Ukraine. It could be assassinations. It could be kill capture type of operations with regard to special forces. All these types of things are in play to achieve that political goal. But I don't know if I would go so far as to say he's going to hold large swaths of Ukrainian territory, because he could achieve a lot of his political objectives and military objectives without having to hold a large swaths of territory. But there are probably going to be some significant acquisitions. I think some of those acquisitions include expansion of the so-called Luhansk and Donetsk republics, people's republics. It's going to include a land bridge from Russia to Crimea. And it very well seems like it's shaping up to include an amphibious operation to gain control of the southern coast of Ukraine, including the largest port of Odessa, and basically cutting Ukraine off from the seas and the oceans. So I think there's something to be said about those cities and those territories being held, but not, maybe severely damaging places, including like Ukraine, and having somebody else pick up the pieces, including the caretaker kind of government that the Russians put in place to carry out their dictates. They don't really care about that. So I think it's going to be a pretty disastrous situation.
All right. So Scott, let's talk about, Alex mentions the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. It's been a while in our adult lifetimes that we've had to use phrases like People's Republics, other than ironically. But Putin chose a very specific modality for orchestrating this invasion, which was, rather than simply send tanks into Ukraine, to stoke this fight between these separatist regions that he had created 6 years ago, and then have the local heads of the Russian pro-Russian communities in these people's republics seek Russian recognition and then move to grant it yesterday and send troops to protect them, allegedly. This is a complicated little dance that he's done that nobody is buying. Why go through this particular act?
That's a really good question. And it's something we need to think through what role this might play in whatever kind of strategic vision he has. But it can play a role in a lot of different fronts, whether it's for domestic audiences, certain international audiences versus others. Essentially, what he's done, just to clarify for folks so that who may not be as familiar with it, is that he's used a type of international act called recognition, which basically says, okay, these entities, Donetsk and Luhansk, meet the requirements for being treated as states under international law in his eyes. And therefore, Russia is going to say, okay, they have all the duties and obligations that are accorded to them by international law to states, as they are now seen as states. Recognition is one of these powers where it is something where the boundaries of where it applies is a little bit fuzzy. The basic criterion are very broad. It's a permanent population fixed territory, ability to govern a government, essentially, and an ability to gauge international relations, and kind of a willingness, which kind of boils down to, you know, do you think of yourself as a state in part, as well as the capacity to actually engage in foreign relations. So those are criterion that you can, the eye of the beholder, apply to lots of different places, potentially. All these principles are supposed to be counterbalanced by the general idea that international law, it weighs very strongly against the degradation of the territorial integrity of existing states and other states, which is part of the reason you do not see many other states signing on to this, that Putin is doing this. But it allows Putin to craft a narrative where under international law, he says, I'm recognizing these people's right, exercising their right to self-determination in Donetsk and Luhansk, and they now are states, and that gives them the right to defend themselves against armed attacks from outsiders, including Ukraine. And they are suffering those armed attacks, and they have asked me to come help, which is within their rights under international laws called collective self-defense. So I can come in, help them defend their borders, and then that essentially frames, both justifies the movement of Russian troops into those territories, and then potentially justifies a military response to Ukraine as the response to an act of aggression, response to an external threat. It's worth noting, as Alex noted already, in declaring or recognizing these territories, he did not just limit either to the territory actually held by the current separatist groups. He recognized it to the whole administrative units of which they are a part, meaning substantial swaths of Ukrainian-controlled territory right now. So why would Putin do this? I think one possibility is that Putin is crafting it as an effort to kind of portray to the international community at least the sense that, to put a kind of cheap metaphor, instead of taking the whole pie, he's just taking two slices of the pie. When you are drawing the line here, he's very clearly signaling he's planning to essentially take these two territories out of Ukraine and put them in nominal independence, largely reliance upon Russia and control under Russia, I would assume. But that's not the same as marching all the way to Kiev. And this might be playing a part of a signaling mechanism saying either genuinely or disingenuously, I don't intend, or at least right now, these military actions I'm pursuing are not headed towards Kiev. This is aimed at securing these more limited holdings. And that could both mean that it is something that might be easier for third-party states observing this to accept, or at least not openly object to, groups like China, groups like, I think India had like somewhat not the strongest language around this in the UN Security Council meeting last night, as I recall, although I apologize if I'm wrong about that from my recollection. You know, it gives them a little bit more of a hook, because instead of just openly repudiating and rejecting core principles of international law, Putin is kind of crafting around them and message and forming an argument, however weak it may be. The other thing it does is it signals to Western parties and essentially says, look, this might be a more limited conflict. Again, maybe genuinely or disingenuously. That gives them an incentive to say, well, both this might be better than the worst outcome that we could have feared, and there may be further actions we also have to deter, meaning we have to keep quivers in our arrow, sanction-wise and otherwise. And that appears to be what we see the Biden administration doing so far. We've seen an announcement of sanctions rolled out. They are broad and robust, but not the full range that was reportedly being contemplated by the administration, at least not yet. Export controls aren't included. There are swaths of private sector institutions that aren't fully included yet. And some of the logic of that might be this keep some quivers in the arrow for further deterrence effect. We don't know whether Putin is serious about this or not. We don't know whether this is him saying, well, I'm going to put forward this narrative so that I can move into these territories, hold them, and then I can decide whether to move on to Kiev. Then I can decide to go elsewhere. Maybe he'll march straight there in the first instance. Although I would say if that were his intention, he would have other still very weak and clearly pretextual, but still other arguments he could make, right? He didn't actually, when he marched into Crimea, make up an argument like this, grant them independence, and then say he was moving in there. He said, oh, this is part of Russian territory, essentially, and claimed it. So, you know, I'm not sure that I think there might be a sign that there's doing something different here in regard to these two territories. But again, whether it's an intermediate step or an end goal may not be something that even Putin's fully decided on yet. But regardless, there's clearly a signaling function that these types of determinations are playing that's different from the approach they took in Crimea.
All right. So you mentioned the rollout of sanctions. Let's talk about what was done and what wasn't done. Scott, give us a rundown of what's in the initial package and what's not there. And then Alex, give us a sense of whether you think this is the right balance the right package for now, or should it have gone further or not as far?
Well, sure. Let me start on that. And I want to caveat by saying that at the time of recording, President Biden literally just gave a speech announcing kind of the next wave of these that I watched, but have not seen actually the official action yet. And it watched very quickly, so I may have missed some details. My understanding of what we've rolled out so far is that last night there was an executive order issued basically imposing a variety of IEEPA-based sanctions and asset freezes for various entities doing business in Donetsk and Luhansk that might have ties to them, installing also basically trying to isolate them internationally, at least any place they intersect with other people who do business with the U.S. financial system. Today, we saw a bigger rollout about major sanctions against major state-owned banks and large financial institutions, a number of prominent individuals, including a number of European and UK sanctions against a number of oligarchs and financial institutions. But things we haven't quite seen yet that I am aware of, but they may still be coming, is there's talk about export controls forthcoming about the United States kind of restrictions. We haven't seen anything on that quite yet, or from allied governments. And we haven't yet seen, as far as I'm aware, but this is something I actually will check on, and I may correct myself in a minute, anything about SWIFT system. There was talk about removing Russia from the SWIFT kind of international financial transactional system, which would severely inhibit its ability to engage in international financial transactions. So I don't believe that those have happened yet, but I could be wrong. There's also talk about another wave of sanctions targeting various individuals and entities, I'm guessing specific businesses, organizations, agencies, and individuals tomorrow. So we may see more action on those fronts. It's worth noting the United States isn't the only one who's taken action like this. We've seen the European Union, the UK take a variety of similar economic sanctions. A lot of those were against entities that were actually already subject to US sanctions, but not all of them. They're kind of ramping up to closer to the US level. We see Germany put a pause on Nord Stream 2, which is certainly notable given the controversy surrounding that. And we've seen a number of other countries, including notably Taiwan, country using country, setting aside the question, which Taiwan is a country, but Taiwan, Japan, and I'm blanking on the third country that officially signaled it today, but a number of major exporters Singapore, East Asia. Was it Singapore or Malaysia?
I think it was, I saw something about Singapore.
Okay, that may be right. And my recollection is that they've agreed to join a similar effort of sanctions, and that's part of an effort to cut out Russian access to various microchips, other type of high technology items that they're providing, among other things. So there is kind of a coordinated international effort that appears to be holding together so far so good that the Biden administration and others have put together.
So Alex, is this what kind of package is this relative to what they could do or what they should do?
Sure. So let me spend just a brief moment addressing this idea of limited aims, just limited to Luhansk and Donetsk, either as their current boundaries or expanded to the entirety of those oblasts, these provinces or states. The reason that is, I think, a bit of wishful thinking is that it does not coincide with regards to Putin's kind of vitriol and rhetoric. And it also doesn't coincide with regards to facts on the ground, the way the Russians positioned forces around Ukraine, and that there is a expiration date on this operation. They can't keep all those troops in the field indefinitely. It's just not realistic from an military operational perspective. Morale is already an issue now. It's always an issue in the military, or Russian military, but it's more of an issue based on the reporting I'm seeing. And also just the readiness, the ability to maintain aircraft in field conditions and even these hardy kind of ground force equipment, it becomes a challenge and it's going to start affecting operational readiness probably within the matter of multiple weeks in their most advanced kind of assault positions, their most forward staging areas. So I think this is likely to coincide with what Putin has said or has kind of signaled, as well as to how the actual military is postured right now. With regards to the sanctions question, the Biden administration settled on an approach that I don't agree with, and I'll explain that in a second. But that approach is to react to Russian provocations, to Russian escalations. And they were holding real firm to this notion of no action until the Russians really do something as significantly escalatory or provocative. And I've been haranguing him about doing what I've called graduated response options. It's this idea that, you can't just do everything in one fell swoop. You also have to signal the fact that you're going to do it You have both the capability and the will to do it, and that they should have done it in conjunction with kind of this constant rising of temperatures and all the activities that they're doing to de facto blockade Ukraine from the seas. Then they could go ahead and go to much heavier options as the Russians escalate. And the reason that you might want to do that is because it has a may very well have a deterrent effect if Vladimir Putin hadn't made a decision. Now, based on the fact that they settled on this idea, I'm really quite happy to see the fairly significant options, the sanctions options or the sanctions actions that they've taken today. Those are not meaningless. The isolation of Russia from the financial system or from the debt markets, that's going to be pretty impactful. From a symbolic standpoint, the sanctioning of 351 Duma members that voted for the recognition of these regions, Luhansk and Donetsk, that's good. There were some, unfortunately, the Brits took a much more kind of limited action. They have a lot of runway to increase it. But I think it's also important to address this question of whether it's enough. It's probably enough to signal that there's more coming without being so heavy-handed where you might be, you know, you might indicate to Putin he's already paid the bill, might as well kind of, you know, eat the whole meal or something of that nature. But this is a part of the issue with the president's approach to this is that Biden's administration limited their arsenal to a much more narrow set of tools as of December. I think there's a policy that we've employed long-term and successfully in Taiwan, for instance, with regards to strategic ambiguity. It's this idea of U.S. forces being employed to defend that strategic partnership. That would have affected Putin's calculus going into this particular crisis. It may have had a significant deterrence effect, but Biden's taken that off the table. It looks like he's basically laid out a very limited approach with regards to posture changes, waiting on the Russians to take significant actions before we position U.S. forces to defend NATO interests. And I think there's also something to be said about the weapons provisions to Ukraine. They've also been quite limited in a way that's probably unhelpful in deterring Russian action here. The provision of some anti-armor capabilities and some air defense by way of the Baltics is not going to change the Russian decision calculus for conducting this operation, but it may on the, you know, tiny bit on the margins affect their tactical decision making on how they conduct their operations, but it's not going to change their fundamental decisions. There are other weapon systems that could have been provided that could have had a more significant effect, like harpoons for coastal defense and even Patriots. Those are sophisticated systems, and the Ukrainians may have not been able to fully pull them into their defensive posture, their defensive operational design, but they would have had some sort of effect. And by not exercising those different options, I think we didn't do enough to avoid this confrontation.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems, too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contains some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. Scott, what do you expect in the coming days? What are the, you mentioned export controls and semiconductors. What are the levers that haven't been pulled yet? And to what extent do you think they will be effective, and to the extent that they're effective, effective at what?
It's all a fair question. You know, I can't claim a deep sanctions expertise over all the different mechanisms that are being used here. And like I said, I'm still catching up on what exactly has been deployed and hasn't been. You know, there are always a range of more entities. There's a number of large financial institutions that still haven't been subjected to specific sanctions. Again, there's the SWIFT cutoff. That's another possible lever. Export controls and other sorts of limitations on trade issues, stricter limitations on the energy sector. I think part of the reservations, part of the limits about all of this is about what the ripple effects are going to be for other actors. Cutting off, you know, major sanctions on the energy sector could have global ramifications for the global economy. Cutting Russia out of Swiss transactions might have like a short to medium term impact, but might also, you know, lead Russia to kind of pursue measures with China or using cryptocurrencies or pursue other measures that kind of get around those obstacles that permanently give it an advantage in evading economic pressure from the United States and creating potentially a system that other actors could join onto as well. So there's all these sorts of balancing acts in how you're rolling out these various things. You know, President Biden in his remarks today made the point very clearly that, you know, the goal is to make sure that Russia feels consequences for this. And I suspect he means Russia, the country, and as well as kind of the leadership and elites. But he also made the point that there are also going to be ramifications for others. While he's going to try and minimize them, there are going to be impacts on other participants in the global economy because of the range of these measures. And, you know, I suspect some of the more severe measures that have yet to be deployed are those that have the higher cost and are likely to be felt there. Doesn't mean they're not a realistic sanction. I think they very well might be, particularly as they go forward. I think the Biden administration, part of, you know, its strategy through all of this is very much been to try and maintain a high degree of coordination on a multilateral basis, including on the sanctions fronts, where a degree of coordination on the sanctions on this particular issue at least seems fairly impressive. Most of the remarks I've seen commenting on say this is a diplomatic success to have this level of buy-in for various economic actors in applying these sanctions. But inevitably, you're going to feel some of these back effects on parts of the global economy. And, you know, you've got to balance those and see how far you can push while keeping that sort of coalition together. It's just a complicated balancing act.
So, Alex, you mentioned, and perhaps we should have started with this because it's the most appalling aspect, you know, the likelihood of massive civilian casualties. The Russian military does not play with the kind of attempts at precision that the U.S. military does, often not as successfully as it would like to. But when the Russians, you know, whether it's Syria or Chechnya or, you know, they still have a kind of level a city kind of approach to military confrontation. You mentioned that you expect this one to be extremely ugly from a civilian risk point of view. What are we realistically talking about?
So there are some, you know, sayings and proverbs that are actually probably pretty informative here. It's something along the lines of, you know, the only thing worse than instability is instability without end. The only thing worse than war is war without end, and so forth. So this is the kind of mindset where the Russians see some humanity and mercy in swift, brutal campaigns to terminate a war as quickly as possible. There's a consistent current of thought around this. I remember reading about, like, you know, the 18th and 19th century conquest of the populations in Central Asia, and this one Russian general, Yermolov, talking about the fact that, you know, if we bleed them enough, we've suppressed, you know, resistance for a generation. It's that kind of mentality that's really is something that doesn't resonate with the Western population. We would often consider military as a tool of last resort. That is not necessarily a thought for Russia. It's a legitimate tool to be considered amongst another set of legitimate tools. And this is not just kind of hypothetical. If we look at how Russia conducted two recent campaigns, they're pretty informative. The Chechen War, the second Chechen War in the late 90s, 99 into the early 2000s, cities were razed. There was no, you know, consideration of collateral damage or non-combatants to indicate that it wasn't just like a view of, you know, how you treat a different ethnic group within Russia. They had the same kind of mentality with regards to combat operations in support of the Assad regime. There, they targeted hospitals and schools. And the thought is that somehow Ukraine being Slavic is going to spare Ukraine some of this pain. That is not the case. You see this campaign to kind of demonize an other, even though they were like a shared population, like a shared roots, they're now considered fascists and banderovci, like ultra nationalists. So these are not the kinds of, it's not the kind of rhetoric or language that indicates that the Russians are going to be a little bit more, you know, careful or cautious. And I think there's something to be said. It's interesting. I mean, this is a kind of like a crossover from the way the U.S. is behaving about the situation to the Russians. What I mean by that is the U.S. policy right now is punitive. It's not deterrent. It's to take punitive actions in response to Russian actions. So the Russians are also in that kind of same mindset. The Ukrainians should know better. They're part of the same population. They're a fake country, but yet they forced Russia's hand to conduct these military offensives. And Putin wants to punish the Ukrainian population. He wants to punish the Ukrainian population for forcing his hand here. And he also wants to punish the Ukrainian population because they were instrumental in realizing the worst tragedy in the 20th century. And you know what that is? According to Vladimir Putin, it's the collapse of the Soviet Union. And for those that understand what happened, it was a vote on December 1st, 1991, that put the nail in the coffin of the Soviet Union. By a overwhelming majority, 90%, voted to leave the Soviet Union and establish a new independent sovereign state. And after that, there are firsthand accounts of Yeltsin saying, well, we can't have a union without Ukraine there. We've lost all the right kind of, you know, Russian Slavs, white Slavs. We're now going to be in the minority. There's no point in preserving the union. And they also terminated the idea of another kind of union, a post-Soviet, a non-communist union, because they bowed out of it. And again, you hear Yeltsin in the record saying, well, we can't do that. We would end up being the minority. So I think this is going to be a punitive expedition. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to be a significant human catastrophe, not just in terms of lives lost, but in terms of lives ruined. Refugees, I know several groups that are preparing for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees. And I'm not even quite sure how the Europeans, Eastern Europeans, prepare for those kinds of numbers streaming across the border.
Especially because if you look at a map, there are, I think, four different EU countries that have borders with Ukraine, and Ukraine has a visa waiver, a non-visa travel to EU countries. And so you wouldn't even have to, people can just walk across those borders, which are in any event very long. I want to ask about how sustainable this is for the Russians. Because, you know, on the one hand, you know, they have one of the most powerful militaries in the world. Ukraine does not, although it is substantially improved over where it was a few years ago, and it's got some modern armaments. On the other hand, as the Afghans proved, it's one thing to take a lot of territory in a country that you overmatch militarily. It's another thing to prevent long-term insurgencies that are very draining and very damaging. How confident should Vladimir Putin be that this is accomplishable, not just in the short term, but in the long term?
Well, I think he should be pretty confident in the short term, I would say. He is likely to achieve his military objectives just based on the devastating, well, the massive capability imbalance and the devastating kind of blows he's likely to land in the first several days, first several hours for that matter. The Ukrainians' major mismatch is in the fact that there is no air force to speak of. There is no naval capability to speak of. The Ukrainians don't have sufficient air defense capabilities to deal with Russian air force and Russian air dominance. And the capabilities on the anti-armor side are there, but they're not going to be sufficient. The Russians have thousands and thousands of armored vehicles. The Ukrainians don't have sufficient anti-armor capabilities. And the mismatch on fires is enormous. The Russians have like, that's where they invest a lot of their resources into ground-based fires. So these are cruise missiles, long-range artillery, like these, you know, super powerful, modern thermal barrack, long-range fires. These are things that, like, you know, wipe out large swaths of territory. So I think the Ukrainians are going to put up a fight. They have the morale to do it. I would say that the Russians don't have the highest morale in a number of their units that they have along their border, but I think those capabilities are just going to be hard to deal with. I hope I'm wrong about that. I hope the fact is that, you know, I'm underestimating how bad the Russian morale is and how much of a difference the high morale, the willingness to sacrifice your life to defend your homeland is going to play into this. But those are just difficult things to overcome. So in the short run, he'll be fine. But that's just in terms of, you know, smashing large Ukrainian military formations. He's still going to have to contend with a situation in which the Ukrainian armed forces recede back into the cities, and he might have to duke it out in the cities. And there's, you know, the whole saying about cities eat armies. That's true. That's that could be he doesn't have anywhere near the combat power to fight through major cities, but he might not need to do that. He might be able to do the things I mentioned earlier: smash the Ukrainian military, destroy their ability to defend themselves, knock out the political leadership, punish the population, and install a puppet government, and then go back to Russian territory after doing like a pretty large smash operation. If he chooses to stay in, I think the Russians have a lot of recourse too, because they're going to be brutal in suppressing insurgencies, and that's going to be costly in terms of lives. But that's a hard one to kind of calculate out. But the biggest miscalculation, of course, for Putin is not on the military side. It's on the holistic national side, the kind of cost that the Putin regime and unfortunately the Russian population is going to have to bear as a result of this. And they will be isolated. We are already, I think, in a Cold War 2.0 scenario. The only trick right now is managing this crisis sufficiently well to avoid a hot war between nuclear powers. But we're in the scenario, and Russia is not going to be able to return to normal. It's going to be isolated for the foreseeable future. And based on these actions on the ground in Ukraine, as they unfold, they'll be a pariah, even difficult for places like China to deal with. I think this is one of those questions, what's China's role here? And it seems there are some small indicators that China is not happy about the direction things are moving in, partially because China recognizes it's going to bear a significant amount of the cost. The Russians may have had some wishful thinking or suggested that they could pressure the Ukrainians into some sort of compromise. That's not happening, and it's moving towards a confrontation that's going to affect the fragile Chinese economy, and it's going to upend the international system in a way that's not helpful to China. A system, by the way, that has helped China become a rising superpower. So I think we'll see how the Chinese play in this, but I think they're likely to be more constructive than seemed to be the case early on.
So Scott, how do you see the diplomacy of this playing out? Assuming we are watching the beginning of something that becomes big and bloody, does the coalition that has formed and that seems kind of on the same page stay together once you get past the first few days?
You know, honestly, my assessment would be that the number one way to keep the coalition that's been putting pressure on Russia is to make it big and bloody. You know, that is the thing where there is the most unity of opinion that what would happen would be bad, and that there is a reason to punish Russia at that point, and an effort to, I guess, deter further escalation to the extent there is space for escalation further up the ladder. You know, that's the calculus that's bringing people together, is the very real threat that Putin is projecting. It's both his source of leverage, but it's also the thing that's proved effective at bringing all these different countries together. So, you know, that actually I think is an easier scenario than if Putin were to slow the advance or to set more limited targets, at least in the interim. That becomes much more challenging, I think, because then you could see a diversity of opinion saying, well, look, you know, he's moved into these separatist areas, but he's not yet moving on Kiev. He's, you know, taken more limited sorts of actions. Yeah, he may be preparing for something down the line, but maybe we have a higher tolerance for this than we would for something greater, and it's worth keeping a greater punitive measure for after the fact that you can deter that. And that means kind of coming to some degree of tacit, no doubt, but acceptance of some of the, you know, fait accompli that Putin's tried to exercise by recognizing these republics and then moving into them. I don't think we have a strong sense. I know Alex is not very confident, and, you know, I would defer to him on assessments of this stuff because I don't follow this particular region nearly as closely as he does. You know, but my general sense is like that becomes a much harder calculus for the coalition of states against Russia to balance with. And why, in my mind, you know, I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that you would see Putin try and take advantage of that, again, by laying out any particular efforts in stages, create ambiguity about his objectives, and potentially trying to introduce some of the more fractious views around some, especially when it comes to some of the harder measures that will be harder both for U.S. and Western allies to swallow, as well as for Russia down the road, as a way of potentially limiting their willingness to infringe on there and basically make some major gains while avoiding some of the higher costs and maybe saving opportunities for later. But that could be wrong. You know, it's entirely possible that this is all just a feint. And in fact, that, you know, the full campaign is going to go forward towards Kiev and the rest of Ukraine. I don't think we know. I think Putin's very deliberately tried to paint things as that's a possibility to have a credible threat as a source of leverage. But, you know, he may very well be fully intending to follow through on that threat. I think that's the point where we get the full scenario that Alex has sketched out for us. But again, if that's the case, I think the global opinion is going to be its most unified. It's the spectrum between the status quo yesterday and that particular outcome that it gets harder to build consensus around an approach to. But I will say, I think the Biden administration's done an impressive job on that so far. And it's clearly been a priority for them. I suspect it's going to continue to be a priority for them.
I just want to second Scott's point about the work that the Biden administration has done. I have been a little bit critical about the fact that given the consequences of what is likely to unfold, we have not done enough to deter it. But there are some pretty amazing things that the Biden administration has done. And the president has been unwavering in his defense of U.S. national security interests, putting him above anything else. You know, the fact that he doesn't want to put American lives on line. And also with regards to the diplomatic efforts to build consensus, he deserves an enormous amount of credit coming after, you know, 4 years of Trump and some seriously damaged relationships. He and his team deserve quite a bit of credit for that.
We are going to leave it there. Alex Vindman, Lieutenant Colonel, former NSC, Defense Minister of Ukraine, Scott R. Anderson, Lawfare Senior Editor, thank you both so much for joining us.
Ben, we can't leave it there. I need to say, I hope I'm completely wrong about everything I just said. That's where I want to leave it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the great Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part. That means you should become a material supporter of Lawfare. You can do that at our Patreon page, patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.